The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Welcome to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon, and you may have heard me before as a guest and a guest host on the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm a pollster, strategist, and CEO of Bannon Communications Research. Bannon Communications polls for and designs research-based media and message strategies for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. My company is the sponsor of today's show. If you want to learn more about me and my political polling and consulting company, check out my Facebook page at Bannon Communications Research. I write a column every week for The Hill on the presidential race. I'm on the National Journal's panel of political insiders, and I'm a national political analyst for WGN TV and radio in Chicago. You can reach me on Twitter at Brad Bannon during the show today. Executive producer Mark Grimaldi is behind the curtains today to keep up my morale and make sure the trains run on time. Today, we have as guests two prominent journalists who will join us to discuss the impact of the Mueller report. In the first half hour, Charlie Cook, publisher and editor of the Cook Political Report, joins us. And in the second half hour, John Bennett of Roll Call joins us from the White House to discuss reaction to the Mueller report there. Charlie, how are you doing today?
Doing well, Brad.
Thanks very much for coming on. I appreciate it. First of all, what was your reaction when you heard about the Mueller report Friday night?
Well, I think that the conspiracy, lack of finding a conspiracy, frankly, didn't surprise me that much, because while clearly the Russians were trying to interfere in our election and trying to sabotage Hillary Clinton's campaign, I never thought that there was a known I didn't think there were conference calls between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence or anything like that. There was a term during the Cold War of useful idiots, where people might not even realize that they were being made tools of an intelligence, and there may have been some of that. So-called exoneration on obstruction of justice, it sounds more like it was that Mueller decided to punt. But to be honest, I think Democrats ought to I think they've chased down enough rabbit holes, and that they would be better advised to spend a little more of their energy and time on November of 2020 than this. The chances of, barring some health event, of President Trump not being in office and not being on the of not being in office in November 2020 are very slim, and they need to prepare for the probability of that rather than spending an inordinate amount of time going the legal impeachment route and spending up time that should be done on organizing a campaign.
Okay. Let me ask you a more general question. Generally, why don't you talk about, since you raised the issue, why don't you what do you think Donald Trump's prospects are for getting reelected?
I think that President Trump's prospects are largely, his fate is largely out of his own hands. That I think he is extremely vulnerable. I think as long as Democrats nominate someone who is not as polarizing, not as controversial as he is, then they have a very good chance of winning. If they present an acceptable alternative, and that whoever they offer is just not seen as an unacceptable risk. The way I look at it, Brad, and you and I have talked about this, I think President Trump has a 35% base that is just absolutely with him no matter what. It doesn't matter what Mueller finds, whatever, it doesn't matter economy, nothing else like that matters. 35% is going to stay with him. And conversely, I think he could find a cure for both cancer and the common cold and ensure peace and tranquility for eternity, and 45% is going to be against him no matter what. So I think this election is going to be about the 20% in the middle, and that those are the people that are up for grabs. There are people that do not either strongly approve of President Trump or strongly disapprove of him. They're up for grabs. For President Trump, if you assume that, generally speaking, if a candidate wins the popular vote by one percentage point, or first of all, if they usually win the popular vote, they usually win the election. Certainly, if you win by one percentage point, you're usually going to win the election. The exceptions, 2016, where Clinton won by 2.1 percentage points and lost the Electoral College vote, that was the widest differential since 1876, Tilden Hayes. But let's just for a moment say that a Democrat needs to win the popular vote by, just make up a number, 3 points to be certain of winning an electoral vote. To get to within 3 points, President Trump would probably need to win between two-thirds and three-quarters of that 20% in the middle. And that's just a group of people that he's not talking to, that he's been doubling down on his base over and over and over again, which has done well for him in terms of reinforcing his base. But every time he does that, it makes it an even steeper incline to get two-thirds or three-quarters of that middle. But we're looking at, when I talk to some people, and probably not that many listeners of this show, but when I talk to some people, there's a presumption that he, among a lot of people, that he's going to get reelected. Well, part of that is based on that incumbent presidents usually get when reelected. Six out of eight elected incumbents since the end of World War II have gotten reelected. They sought reelection, have gotten reelected. But President Trump's job approval ratings have consistently trailed both the six that were reelected and even the two, Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush, that were not reelected. You look at the intensity, there's generally between 1.4 and 1.8 people strongly disapprove for every one person that strongly approves. So that I think he's in a very, very tough situation, and that if Democrats nominated a potted plant, they'd probably win. But if they nominated someone that seemed to be a high-risk candidate, they could lose this.
Okay. Let's go back to you. You mentioned there are basically about 20%, one out of five voters on the fence on the president. Can you make any general statements about the kind of people that are reside in that 20% range?
It's interesting. You could say, and these would be, they're pretty obvious, independents and moderates. But the thing is, they don't have many other, demographic characteristics that just sort of jump out. And the question is, how many of those 20 are really going to vote? And I know a lot of people look at independents and say, independents make up, 30, 40, 40-something percent of all adults or of the electorate. Well, yeah, that's true, but the biggest slice of those lean one way or the other, and when you find an independent and you push them and they say they lean Democratic, you'll find that they vote Democratic about 80% of the time. And the same thing for the independents who vote lean Republican, that they vote Republican about 80% of the time. So it's not quite the 90% that partisans do, but it's a pretty darn high number. But of the pure independents, the people that are really in the middle, it's sort of, that's actually around high single digits. They, you know, a lot of these are people, there's, you know, if you're not a Democrat and you're not a Republican and you're not a liberal and you're not a conservative, there's a really good chance that you just don't think about politics very much, that you don't read newspapers, you don't listen, watch television news, you don't listen to political shows on the radio, that you're kind of checked out. And the question is whether those people actually vote or how many of those people actually vote. And that's a really good question. So that 20%, that's a big number. You know, it may actually be smaller than that. But they don't jump out demographically, you know, skew age-wise or age or income or anything like that noticeably.
Okay. We're going to go to break next, but when we're back with Deadline DC, we're going to talk more to Charlie Cook, editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report. We'll be back after this message. This is Brad Bannon. I'm back with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest is Charlie Cook, who is the publisher and editor of the Cook Political Report. Charlie, give me your impression of the Democratic field of presidential candidates. How does that situation look?
Well, you know, at this point, you know, we're just sort of guessing. But the way I look at it is it's like the NCAA basketball tournament, although thankfully they're not 64 Democratic candidates. But let's start with the Sweet 16. I try to figure out, okay, who's likely to make the Final Four? And, you know, just sort of my theory is that you've got a left lane that is dominated most, you know, by Bernie Sanders, but Elizabeth Warren is also competing in that same pool of votes. And so one of those two will occupy one of the final four slots. I figure Joe Biden will likely pick up another one, sort of the one on the furthest from the left. Then that leaves two, and one sort of for the young minority and or female slot, and young, exciting, that sort of thing. Right now, I think Kamala Harris would have the inside track on that one. And then you've got the wild card, maybe a dozen candidates competing for the fourth slot. And right now, if you were going to say who's got the inside track on that one, you'd probably say Beto O'Rourke. So, you know, but you know, there's a whole campaign ahead of us and a lot of sifting through. But, you know, if I had today, if you put a gun up my head, those would be the most likely people to make it into the Final Four, and then after that, it's just anybody's guess.
It seems to me that obviously everybody knows about Bernie and Biden. Why do you think Kamala Harris has got such a good start? She does seem to be attracting a lot of attention. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there is a large pool of African-American voters in Democratic primaries. African-American women turn out at a higher rate than African-American men do. I think there's also a very strong sort of generational appeal that she's got going for her. And she had a big launch. You know, I think she's going to be amply funded. It's just sort of all the elements that one would need to kind of move beyond Sweet 16 and get into the eight and get into the Final Four. But, you know, it's hardly a lock. But I think she had a very strong start.
There's been some conversation. As you mentioned, there are two or three of the Democratic candidates who have very strong, passionate followings. I'm thinking Bernie Sanders as one of them. And there are others who really, you know, even Kamala Harris, I don't think very many voters nationally know who she is. Are the Democrats better off with someone who's been around the block before, like Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, and have high national profiles? Or are they better off with one of the candidates who is largely unknown at this point, but might emerge to be a strong challenger?
I don't think we know that. I don't think we can possibly know that at that point, and we'll just have to kind of watch watch as the campaign unfolds. But, just looking at yesterday's Fox News poll that came out among Democratic primary caucus, people likely to participate in Democratic primaries and caucuses, you had those four that I mentioned were at the top. I mean, Biden at 31, Bernie Sanders at 23, Kamala Harris and Beto O'Rourke each had 8. Now, polls this far out are not very good predictors of who is going to win the nominee, but it does tend to separate, okay, who's, who is getting some traction and who is not. And I think it's pretty safe to say this moment that a Kamala Harris or Beto O'Rourke, that they're getting more traction than, say, Cory Booker or Kirsten Gillibrand or some of the others. But I think it's how great of a risk. Most Democrats, most liberals I know, the thing they fear more than anything else in 2020 is or the thing that would be the worst thing that could possibly happen in 2020 would be a giant meteor hits the world and kills us all. But this close second is Donald Trump getting reelected. And so the question is, how much of a risk? What is their risk tolerance? And how much of a risk do they want to do? And it gets to, and the other question is this thing of, do you want someone who can reach into the middle or someone that can draw out a strong vote out of the base, build intensity within the party? I personally don't think it's either or. I think it's a matter, that you, to succeed in life, you generally have to walk and chew gum at the same time, and you got to generally do both. But it's more often than not, someone who's really good at reaching into the middle doesn't get a passion within the base, and vice versa. And that when that does, when someone can successfully do both, either they are extraordinary candidate, charismatic candidate, or these are desperate times with like a economic recession or a financial crisis or something like that, where someone's been able to do both simultaneously. But
well, Charlie, sadly, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Deadline DC. I know you're very busy, and I hope we can get you to come back and talk about the presidential race at some point. We'll be back with more of Deadline DC and John Bennett from Roll Call after these messages. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Bannon Communications Research polls foreign designs, research-based media and message strategies for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. My company is the sponsor of today's show. If you want to learn more about me and my political polling and consulting company, check out Facebook at Bannon Communications Research. Our guest in this half hour is John Bennett, White House correspondent for Roll Call. John joins us from the belly of the beast today in the Trump White House. Good afternoon, John. How are you doing today?
Good, Brad. How are you?
Fine. Thanks very much for joining us. Well, are there people dancing in the aisles at the White House today?
I wouldn't say they're dancing, but boy, there are a lot of very wide smiles, very, very bright faces. Once you kind of engage them on some of the specifics of what the Attorney General wrote in his letter yesterday and some of the things that Democrats have both been saying over the last 20 or so hours or 24 hours, and what they've been saying for the last 2.5 years, they do turn angry. It's almost like that bitterness, after a breakup or when you talk about an employer that things ended badly with. It's just that very human. It's a very human day at the White House. They do feel vindicated, but they're also upset, and some of them are angry. I think the president has some residual anger, and I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
Well, let me read this. I just saw this on the break. And it's a quote from the White House spokesperson, Sarah Sanders. And it she says, they literally accused the president of the United States of being an agent for a foreign government. That's equivalent to treason. That's punishable by death in this country. That's a pretty strong statement.
It's a very strong statement. Both she and the president using the T word today. She said treason, and later in the Oval Office with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, the president said some people involved in the special counsel investigation, and remember there was a Justice Department investigation that then became the Mueller investigation. The president didn't name anyone. He does this a lot. He's very vague, kind of dancing around things, but said those people committed treasonous acts. Sarah also suggesting, Sarah and the president suggesting that folks should be, in the president's words, looked at here, kind of alluding to some other kind of investigation. So this is not going to go away, but the rhetoric today is very ramped up, using words like treasonous and suggesting people be investigated. Sarah this morning, she did a number of television hits, and she was on CNN, and she accused Democrats of working to overthrow the sitting president, to overthrow President Trump. So as the day went on, the rhetoric definitely escalated. So, they're talking about cover-ups and plots to overthrow the government, essentially, and treason. I mean, the allegations really don't get more serious than that around here. But I will tell you, if this had been 3 years ago and somebody threw that around, it would be taken a lot more seriously. This kind of is one of the Trump effects. We've got the president and his top spokesperson, easy for me to say, throwing around these very serious charges and very serious allegations. And, I mean, we report it as news. We try to be as professional. But kind of what I feel from the public, even folks here in Washington, it's just kind of a shrug now. It's just Monday. It's just another Monday.
Well, sometimes I think I don't live in the same dimension as the president. I mean, it seemed to me that any other president would have reacted to the news today. Glad the investigation is over. We're exonerated. It's time to move on and bring Americans together so we can solve the nation's problems. Instead, we get talk of treason. Am I crazy or are they crazy?
Well, sometimes I wonder if we've all gone a little bit crazy in the last 2 years just with, and I don't mean that as a partisan statement, it's just been so frenetic and things that didn't happen, and like you said, things that a president wouldn't say are said or tweeted on a daily or every other daily basis. So there is, and trust me, as someone who kind of does this as a one-man bureau, there is an effect here. There is an effect on all of us that the last 2.5 years have had. But the president is certainly not trying to sound very unifying. In recent days, he's talked again about an infrastructure bill. He has not talked about that since this report or since what we saw from the attorney general, at least. They're not talking about getting some Democrats over to the White House on Thursday or early next week and start negotiating an infrastructure bill, which is something that both sides want to do. They agree on, sources have told me, we agree on 80%, maybe not how to pay for it all, but we agree on 80% of the projects and 50% of the financing. We can get there. That's what I've been told over the last 2.5 years. There is a feeling they could even get there. And the 2020 campaign is ramped up, but there's a feeling they could get something on the president's desk by the August recess if they got serious on infrastructure. But he's not talking about that. And on the flip side, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Jerry Nadler, John Warner, I could go on. Democrats aren't talking about that now. Like, okay, Mueller did his work. Let's get with the president and let's do something on infrastructure. Both sides are just digging in, very predictable given our new politics, I think. And the president seems to want some revenge here, and Democrats want to see what is actually in the Mueller report, and especially they want to see some of the underlying evidence that they think will show maybe not criminal-level wrongdoing, but still wrongdoing. And that's a point that maybe didn't come over in Barr's four-page letter as clearly as maybe it should have. What both Mueller and Barr and Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, what they were looking at, both in the special counsel report and then in the letter Barr and Rosenstein helped craft that went to lawmakers, Mueller looked at it very much like a prosecutor, like a law enforcement official. He was looking for that criminal level beyond a reasonable doubt. He didn't get over that, and Democrats now want to see how close he got to clearing that hurdle.
Okay. Our guest in this half hour is John Bennett of Roll Call, who covers the White House for Roll Call and is speaking to us from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We have a caller on the line, John, and let's go to him right now. It's our good friend, Michael from the Bronx. Michael, how are you today?
Hello, Brad, and hello to your guests hanging in there, given the nonsense that we're constantly hearing. And I don't know what the hell these GOPs in the White House are dancing about, because they're still in big trouble with the multiple investigations that are still pending. But nonetheless, let's just focus on this Mueller report, which I find, or should I say, I smell a rat. Because you're not going to tell me, first of all, that with thousands and thousands of pages in this report, that they were able to read it thoroughly within 48 hours, where the average person takes up to a week to week and a half to read a book that is an average of 200 to 400 pages. That's problem number one. Problem number two, that Mr. Barr is already on record beforehand, before even the confirmation hearings, saying that there's no collusion. So he already had a prejudicial notion here. And then the fact that you're going to rush this whole thing in, I would want to see the Democrats subpoena this report, but also subpoena Mr. Mueller and Barr, having testified under oath as to how they came to these findings. And barring the words from the late Johnny Cochran, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. And I'm saying if it doesn't fit, it's not legit.
Okay, well, let's ask John about this. John, Michael brings up a good point. How big a fight do you think there's going to be from the Trump White House and from the Attorney General on releasing the full, unexpurgated version of the Mueller report?
I think it'll be a pretty big fight here already. You have Trump folks and talking about we're going to have to look at executive privilege. I think a legitimate point that Sarah Sanders made this morning is that it'll have to go through the intel community. We'll have to review it if it is being prepared for release or partial release. I'm almost certain there are intelligence agents and assets that are probably mentioned in the report. You'll have to redact that. You can't put those folks at risk. You can't put their families at risk, and you can't put whatever missions they might be working on at risk. So, I don't think we'll ever see the full report for that very reason. It would be a redacted version. The fight would be over executive privilege, and just how far the White House and the Attorney General want to go down that path and have that fight. We could predict a scenario where we get a partial report or a more extended summary of the report from Mueller, and then Democrats really make a lot of noise and start calling people up to testify and really pushing to see as much of it as we can. Sometimes in Washington, even with some norms do hold under Trump, and a lot of times we see these things kind of in drips and drabs and bit by bit, and then we get a fuller product. That could be What happens, Democrats will want to drag William Barr and Bob Mueller and anyone else they can think of to the Hill to testify publicly. While a lot of the candidates, the Democratic candidates, aren't really talking about the Mueller report or the Russia investigation on the campaign trail, Democrats in Washington certainly want to focus on it. But what you're hearing some this morning, some of the freshmen like Katie Hill from California, you know, she worked in the Obama White House, she's stressing the importance of some of the other investigations they have into the Trump White House, with the child separation policy, the migrant family separation policy. She's stressing the importance, and I noticed she was on more than one network this morning, saying that we need to keep our eye on the ball, and we might need to focus a little bit more on these other investigations. So Democrats aren't going to slow down here. They're going to keep going, but you know there is a risk of backfire that they could be seen, you know, like House Republicans with President Clinton going too far, maybe being unfair, and boy, if there's any one candidate who can turn that into gold for himself, it is Donald J. Trump. And they really do have to walk a fine line here. They have a very it's going to be a tightrope for Democrats on how they play this, because they could easily step on their left foot with their right foot, and he could win pretty easily.
It's a fine balance. So we're going to break now, but when we finish the break, we'll be back with John Bennett of Roll Call, who's talking about the White House reaction to the Mueller report. We'll be back right after this. We are back with more of Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon, and our guest in this half hour is John Bennett, who covers the White House for Roll Call. John, you told our listeners that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in the White House today. Was there anything of substance to come from that meeting, or is this just your, you know, basic political photo op?
A little bit of both. The Prime Minister did cut short his trip because of the rocket attacks. Back home, he was supposed to be here through tomorrow evening, but he is actually leaving today. He may have already left the States, maybe on his way back. But it was important for Netanyahu to be seen beside the American president. Israel really depends on the U.S. Military aid, a close ally in the region. If there's ever going to be any kind of peace or semi-peace deal, America, whoever's in the White House is going to be involved in making that happen. And of course, Trump has done a number of things that are seen as pro-Israel, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and recognizing it as the capital, the Golan Heights. You know, he signed a proclamation today formally making U.S. policy that the U.S. recognizes the Golan area as sovereign Israeli territory. That's a big change. George Bush didn't do that. Ronald Reagan didn't do that. Certainly Barack Obama and Bill Clinton didn't do that. So it was more important for Netanyahu to be seen with Trump for that reason. Trump has been at the White House, they say he's the most pro-Israel president in U.S. history. I will let the foreign policy experts handle that one, but this was mostly for Netanyahu today. It did give Trump a chance to answer some questions about the Mueller probe. Again, that's where the treasonous comment came from. But they didn't really get as much as they wanted out of this visit. There was supposed to be a dinner tomorrow night at the White House in Netanyahu's honor. That would have given him a lot of play back home as he faces re-election. And also, Netanyahu has been indicted, part of a corruption scandal. as he faces this reelection test. So there was more on the line here for Netanyahu than for Trump. But with Trump, it's good for the evangelicals who are so, you know, pro-Israel. And for Trump, it was important there. And remember, every little thing Trump does has more than a little to do with that conservative base, and the evangelical voters are very important to that. So there was something in here for Trump, too, but mostly for Netanyahu.
Did he use his meeting with the Israeli prime minister today as an opportunity? He's been taking several shots at Democrats in the last week or so as for being anti-Jewish. Did he raise that today?
He did not today. That was very interesting. You know, sometimes President Trump does act a little more conventionally presidential. And at least on that score today, he did just that. He didn't go after Democrats at all, and certainly not with, you know, some of the very harsh words he's had in recent weeks about how they're an anti-Jewish party. So at least on that today, President Trump stuck to the script. He doesn't always do that, of course.
Let me ask you another question. Trump administration has been slow to release a list of Pentagon military projects that might be unfunded or defunded or minimally less funded because of taking the money for the wall. Has that the Trump administration released that list yet, or is that going to be a big fight to get that information?
It's going to be a big fight. The committees on the Hill that would have jurisdiction over that are still fighting with the White House over that. That's, of course, you know, Congress has the power of the purse. It's not exactly clear in law. Some experts tell me, experts who have both worked on defense budgets in the government and folks who have watched it their entire career, it's not exactly clear if Congress will have to, by law or DOD guidelines, approve some of those funding shifts out of those programs and into the wall. That, of course, part of some of these lawsuits since the president declared his national emergency at the border. And it just like whether he can declare the national emergency, his ability to shift the funds on his own could actually be the more legally contentious part of all this, and the courts probably are going to end up deciding whether he can do that. The list, I think, lawmakers will eventually get that and be satisfied that they at least have the information on where the money would come from. But the White House is going to have a legal fight on whether they can actually move the dollars.
Okay, John, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I hope you have the time. I know you're probably very busy over there, but I hope you have the time to join us again on Deadline DC. And that's it for us for today, folks. I'll be back next Tuesday, if the Lord is willing. The creek don't rise. Unless, of course, Donald Trump accuses me of treason or just declares martial law. No.